realizing how much can go wrong. Alex looked up at her, frozen. Oh, Josie. Anyway, I didn't mean to make you... Let's just drop it, okay? Josie forced a smile. He's not bad-looking, you know, for someone that old. He's a year younger than I am, Alex pointed out. My mother, the cradle robber. Josie picked up the plate of pancakes and passed it. These are getting cold. Alex took the plate. Thank you, she said, but she held Josie's gaze just long enough for her daughter to realize what Alex was really grateful for. Just then, Patrick came creeping down the stairs. At the landing, he turned to give Alex a thumbs-up sign. Patrick, she called out, Josie's made us some pancakes. Selena knew the party line. You were supposed to say that there was no difference between boys and girls, but she also knew if you asked any mom or nursery school teacher, they'd tell you differently, off the record. This morning, she sat on a park bench watching Sam negotiate a sandbox with a group of fellow toddlers. Two little girls were pretending to bake pizzas made out of sand and pebbles. The boy beside Sam was trying to demolish a dump truck by smashing it repeatedly into the sandbox's wooden frame. No difference, Selena thought. Yeah, right. She watched with interest as Sam turned from the boy beside him and started to copy the girls, sifting sand into a bucket to make a cake. Selena grinned, hoping that this was some small clue that her son would grow up to act against stereotype and do whatever he was most comfortable doing. But did it work that way? Could you look at a child and see who he'd become? Sometimes when she studied Sam, she could glimpse the adult he'd be one day. It was there in his eyes, the shell of the man he would grow to inhabit. But it was more than physical attributes you could sometimes puzzle out. Would these little girls become stay-at-home Betty Crocker moms, or business entrepreneurs like Mrs. Fields? Would the little boy's destructive behavior bloom into drug addiction or alcoholism? Had Peter Houghton shoved playmates, or stomped on crickets, or done something else as a child that might have predicted his future as a killer? The boy in the sandbox put down the truck and moved on to digging, seemingly to China. Sam abandoned his baking to reach for the plastic vehicle, and then he lost his balance and fell down, smacking his knee on the wooden frame. Selena was out of her seat in a shot, ready to scoop up her son before he started to bawl. But Sam glanced around at the other kids, as if realizing he had an audience, and although his little face furrowed and reddened, a raisin of pain, he didn't cry. It was easier for girls. They could say, "This hurts," or, "I don't like how this feels," and have the complaint be socially acceptable. Boys, though, didn't speak that language. They didn't learn it as children, and they didn't manage to pick it up as adults either. Selena remembered last summer when Jordan had gone fishing with an old friend whose wife had just filed for divorce. "What did you talk about?" she asked when Jordan came home. "Nothing," Jordan had said. "We were fishing." This had made no sense to Selena. They'd been gone for 6 hours. How could you sit beside someone in a small boat for that long and not have a heart-to-heart about how he was doing, if he was holding up in the wake of this crisis, if he worried about the rest of his life? She looked at Sam, who now had the dump truck in his hand and was rolling it across his former pizza. Change could come that quickly, Selena knew. She thought of how Sam would wrap his tiny arms around her and kiss her, how he'd come running to her if she held out her arms. But sooner or later, he'd realize that his friends didn't hold their mother's hands when they crossed the street, that they didn't bake pizzas and cakes in the sandbox. Instead, they built cities and dug caverns. One day, in middle school, or even earlier, Sam would start to hole himself up in his room. He would shy away from her touch. He would grunt his responses, act tough, be a man. Maybe it was our own damn fault that men turned out the way they did, Selena thought. Maybe empathy, like any unused muscle, simply atrophied. Josie told her mother that she had gotten a summer job volunteering with the school system to tutor middle and elementary school kids in math. She talked about Angie, whose parents had split up during the school year and who had failed algebra as an indirect consequence. She described Joseph, a leukemia patient who'd missed school for treatment and had the hardest time understanding fractions. Every day at dinner, her mother would ask her about work, and Josie would have a story. The problem was, it was just that, a fiction. Joseph and Angie didn't exist, and for that matter, neither did Josie's tutoring job. This morning, like every morning, Josie left the house. She got on the advanced transit bus and said hello to Rita, the driver who'd been on this route all summer. When the other passengers got off at the stop that was closest to the school, Josie stayed in her seat. She didn't get up, in fact, until the very last stop, the one that was a mile south of the Whispering Pines Cemetery. She liked it there. At the cemetery, she didn't run into anyone she didn't feel like talking to. She didn't have to speak at all if she wasn't in the mood. Josie walked up the winding trail, which was so familiar to her by now that she could tell, with her eyes closed, when the pavement was going to make a dip and when it would veer left. She knew that the violently blue hydrangea bush was halfway to Matt's grave, that you could smell honeysuckle when you were only steps away from it. By now, there was a headstone, a pristine block of white marble with Matt's name carefully carved. Grass had started to grow. Josie sat down on the raised hummock of dirt, which was warm, as if the sun had been seeping into the earth and holding that heat in wait for her. She reached into her backpack and took out a bottle of water, a peanut butter sandwich, a bag of saltines. "Can you believe school's starting in a week?" she said to Matt, because sometimes she did that. It wasn't like she expected him to answer. It just felt better talking to him after so many months of not talking. "They're not opening the real school yet, though. They said maybe by Thanksgiving, when the construction's done." What they were actually doing to the school was a mystery. Josie had driven by enough to know that the gymnasium and library had been torn down, as had the cafeteria. She wondered if the administration was naive enough to think that if they got rid of the scene of the crime, the students could be fooled into thinking it never happened. She'd read somewhere that ghosts didn't just hang around physical locations, that sometimes a person could be haunted. Josie hadn't really considered herself big on the paranormal, but this she believed. There were some memories, she knew, you could run from forever and never shake. Josie lay down, her hair spread over the newborn grass. "Do you like having me here?" she whispered. "Or would you tell me to get lost, if you were the one who could talk?" She didn't want to hear the answer. She didn't even really want to think about it. So she opened her eyes as wide as she could and stared into the sky, until the brilliant blue burned the backs of her eyes. Lacey stood in the men's department at Filene's, touching her hands to the bristled tweeds and hollowed blue and puckered seersucker fabrics of the sports jackets. She'd driven 2 hours to Boston so that she would have the best choices to outfit Peter for his trial. Brooks Brothers, Hugo Boss, Calvin Klein, Ermene Gildo Zegna. They had been made in Italy, France, Britain, California. She peeked at a price tag, sucked in her breath, and then realized she didn't care. This would most likely be the last time she would ever buy clothes for her son. Lacey moved systematically through the department. She picked up boxer shorts made of the finest Egyptian cotton, a packet of Ralph Lauren white tees, cashmere socks. she found khaki trousers, 30 by 30. She plucked a button-down Oxford shirt off a rack because Peter had always hated having his collar peek out from a crewneck sweater. She chose a blue blazer, as Jordan had instructed. "We want him dressed as if you're sending him to Phillips Exeter," he had said. She remembered how, when Peter was around 11, he developed an aversion to buttons. You'd think it would be easy to get around something like that, but it eliminated most pants. Lacey could remember driving to the ends of the earth to find elastic waist flannel plaid pajama pants that might double for daily wear. She remembered seeing kids wearing pajama bottoms to school as recently as last year, and wondering if Peter had started the trend or simply been slightly out of sync. Even after Lacey had gathered what she needed, she continued to walk through the men's department. She touched a rainbow of silk handkerchiefs that melted over her fingers, choosing one that was the color of Peter's eyes. She rifled through leather belts, black, brown, stippled, alligator, and neckties printed with dots, with fleur-de-lis, with stripes. She picked up a bathrobe that was so soft it nearly brought her to tears, shearling slippers, a cherry-red bathing suit. She shopped until the weight in her arms was as heavy as a child.
"Oh, let me help you with those," a saleswoman said, taking some of the items from her arms and carrying them to the counter. She began to fold them one by one. "I know how it feels," she said, smiling sympathetically. "When my son went away, I thought I was going to die."
Lacey stared at her. Was it possible that she wasn't the only woman who had gone through something as awful as this? Once you had, like this salesperson, would you be able to pick others out of a crowd, as if there were a secret society of those mothers whose children cut them to the quick?
"You think it's forever," the woman said, "but believe me, once they come home for Christmas break or summer vacation and start eating you out of house and home again, you'll be wishing college was year-round."
Lacey's face froze.
"Right," she said. "College. I've got a girl at the University of New Hampshire, and my son's at Rochester," the saleswoman said. "Harvard. That's where my son's going."
They had talked about it once. Peter liked the computer science department at Stanford better, and Lacey had joked around, saying she'd throw away any brochures from colleges west of the Mississippi because they were so far away. The state prison was 60 miles south, in Concord.
"Harvard," the saleswoman said. "He must be a smart one."
"He is," Lacey said. And she continued to tell this woman about Peter's fictional transition to college, until the lie didn't taste like licorice on her tongue, until she could nearly believe it herself. Just after 3 o'clock, Josie rolled over onto her belly, spread her arms wide, and pressed her face into the grass. It looked like she was trying to hold on to the ground, which, she supposed, wasn't all that far from the truth. She breathed in deeply. Usually she smelled nothing but weeds and soil, but every now and then, when it had just rained, she got the barest scent of ice and pert shampoo, as if Matt were still himself just under that surface. She gathered the wrapper from her sandwich and her empty water bottle and put them into her backpack, then headed down the winding path to the cemetery gates. There was a car blocking the entrance. Only twice this summer had Josie been present when a funeral procession came, and it had made her a little sick to her stomach. She started to walk faster, in the hope that she would be long gone and sitting on her advanced transit bus before the service began, and then she realized that the car blocking the gates was not a hearse, not even black for that matter. It was the same car that had been parked in their driveway this morning, and Patrick was leaning against it with his arms crossed.
"What are you doing here?" Josie asked.
"I could ask you the same thing."
She shrugged.
It's a free country. Josie didn't really have anything against Patrick Ducharme himself. He just made her nervous, on so many counts. She couldn't look at him without thinking of that day. But now she had to, because he was also her mother's lover. How weird was it to say that? And in a way, that was even more upsetting. Her mother was on cloud nine, falling in love, while Josie had to sneak off to a graveyard to visit her boyfriend. Patrick pushed himself off the car and took a step toward her.
Your mother thinks you're teaching long division right now.
Did she tell you to stalk me? Josie said.
I prefer surveillance,
Patrick corrected. Josie snorted. She didn't want to sound like such a snot, but she couldn't help it. Sarcasm was like a force field. Once she turned it off, he might be able to see that she was this close to falling to pieces.
Your mother doesn't know I'm here, Patrick said. I wanted to talk to you.
I'm gonna miss my bus.
Then I'll drive you wherever you want to go, he said, exasperated. You know, when I'm doing my job, I spend a lot of time wishing I could turn back the clock, get to the rape victim before it happened, stake out the house before the thief comes by. I know what it's like to feel like nothing you do or say is ever going to make things better. And I know what it's like to wake up in the middle of the night, replaying one moment over and over so vividly that you might as well be living it again. In fact, I bet you and I replay the same moment.
Josie swallowed. In all these months, out of all the well-meaning conversations she'd had with doctors and psychiatrists and even other kids from the school, no one had captured so succinctly what it felt like to be her. But she couldn't let Patrick know that, couldn't admit to her weakness, even though she had the feeling that he could spot it all the same.
Don't pretend we have anything in common, Josie said. But we do, Patrick replied. Your mother.
He looked Josie in the eye.
I like her. A lot. And I'd like to know that you're okay with that.
Josie felt her throat closing. She tried to remember Matt saying that he liked her. She wondered if anyone would ever say it again.
My mother's a big girl. She can make her own decisions about who she don't.
Patrick interrupted.
Don't what?
Don't say something you're gonna wish you hadn't. Josie stepped back, her eyes glittering.
If you think that buddying up to me is gonna win her over, you're wrong. You're better off with flowers and chocolate. She couldn't care less about me. That's not true. You haven't exactly been around long enough to know, have you? Josie, Patrick said, she's crazy about you.
Josie felt herself choke on the truth, even harder to speak than it was to swallow.
But not as crazy as she is about you. She's happy. She's happy, and I know I should be happy for her.
But you're here, Patrick said, gesturing at the cemetery.
And you're alone.
Josie nodded and burst into tears. She turned away, embarrassed, and then felt Patrick fold his arms around her. He didn't say anything, and for that one moment, she even liked him. Any word at all, even a well-meaning one, would have taken up the space where her hurt needed to be. He just let her cry until finally it all stopped, and Josie rested for a moment against his shoulder, wondering if this was only the eye of the storm or its end point.
I'm a bitch, she whispered. I'm jealous. I think she'd understand.
Josie drew away from him and wiped her eyes.
Are you gonna tell her I come here?
No. She glanced up at him, surprised. She would have thought that he'd take her mother's side.
You're wrong, you know, Patrick said.
About what?
Being alone.
Josie glanced up the hill. You couldn't see Matt's grave from the gates, but it was still there, just like everything else about that day.
Ghosts don't count.
Patrick smiled.
Mothers do.
What Lewis hated the most was the sound of the metal doors slamming. It hardly mattered that 30 minutes from now he'd be able to leave the jail. What was important was that the inmates couldn't, and that one of those inmates was the same boy he'd taught to ride a bike without training wheels, the same boy whose nursery school paperweight was still sitting on Lewis's desk, the same boy he'd watched take his very first breath. He knew it would be a shock for Peter to see him. How many months had he told himself that this would be the week he got up the courage to see his son in jail, only to find another errand to run or paper to study? But as a correctional officer opened up a door and led Peter into the visitation room, Lewis realized that he'd underestimated what a shock it would be for him to see Peter. He was bigger, maybe not taller, but broader. His shoulders filled out his shirt. His arms had thickened with muscle. His skin was translucent, almost blue under this unnatural light. His hands didn't stop moving. They were twitching at his sides, and then, when he sat down, on the sides of the chair.
"Well," Peter said, "what do you know?"
Lewis had rehearsed 6 or 7 speeches, explanations of why he hadn't been able to bring himself to see his son, but when he saw Peter sitting there, only 2 words rose to his lips.
"I'm sorry."
Peter's mouth tightened.
"For what? Blowing me off for 6 months?" "I was thinking," Lewis admitted, "more like 18 years.
Peter sat back in his chair, staring at Lewis. He forced himself to return the stare. Could Peter grant him absolution, even if Lewis still wasn't entirely sure he could return the favor? Rubbing a hand down his face, Peter shook his head. Then he started to smile. Lewis felt his bones loosen, his muscles relax. Until this moment, he hadn't really known what to expect from Peter. He could reason with himself all he wanted, and assert that an apology would always be accepted. He could remind himself that he was the parent here, the one in charge. But all of that was extremely hard to remember when you were sitting in a visiting room at a jail with a woman on your left who was trying to play footsie with her lover across that forbidden red line, and a man on your right who was cursing a blue streak. The smile on Peter's face hardened, twisted into a sneer.
"Fuck you," he spat out. "Fuck you for coming here. You don't give a shit about me. You don't want to tell me you're sorry. You just want to hear yourself say it. You're here for yourself, not me."
Lewis's head felt as if it were filled with stones. He bent forward, the stalk of his neck unable to bear the weight anymore, until he could rest his forehead in his hands.
"I can't do anything, Peter," he whispered. "I can't work. I can't eat. I can't sleep."
Then he lifted his face.
"The new students, they're coming onto the college campus right now. I look at them out my window. They're always pointing at the buildings or down Main Street or listening to the tour guides who take them across the courtyard. And I think of how much I was looking forward to doing those same things with you."
He had written a paper years ago, after Joey was born, about the exponential increases of happiness. The moments that the quotient changed by leaps and bounds after a triggering incident. What he'd concluded was that the outcome was variable, based not on the event that caused the happiness, but rather the state you were in when it happened. For example, the birth of a child was one thing when you were happily married and planning a family. It was something entirely different when you were 16 and had gotten a girl knocked up. Cold weather was perfect if you were on a skiing vacation, but disappointing if you happened to be enjoying a week at the beach. A man who was once rich might be deliriously happy with a dollar in the middle of a depression. A gourmet chef would eat worms if stranded on a desert island. A father who had hoped for a son that was educated and successful and independent might,
under different circumstances, simply be happy to have him alive and safe, so that he could tell the boy he'd never stopped loving him.
"But you know what they say about college,"
Lewis said, sitting up a little straighter.
"It's overrated."
His words surprised Peter.
"All those parents forking over $40,000 a year,"
Peter said, smiling faintly.
"And here I am, getting the most out of your tax dollar."
"What more can an economist ask for?"
Lewis joked. Although this wasn't funny. Never would be funny. And he realized that this was a sort of happiness, too. You would say anything, do anything, to keep your son smiling like that, as if there was something to still smile about, even if every word felt like you were swallowing glass.
Patrick's feet were crossed on the prosecutor's desk as Diana Levin scanned the reports that had come from ballistics days after the shooting in preparation for his testimony at the trial.
"There were two shotguns, which were never used," Patrick explained, "and two matching handguns, Glock 17s, that were registered to a neighbor across the street, a retired cop."
Diana glanced up over the papers. "Lovely."
"Yeah, well, you know cops. What's the point of putting the gun in a locked cabinet when you have to get at it quickly? Anyway, gun A is the one that was fired around most of the school. The striations on the bullets we recovered match it. Gun B was fired, ballistics told us that, but there hasn't been a bullet recovered that matches its barrel. That gun was found jammed on the floor of the locker room. Houghton was still holding gun A when he was apprehended."
Diana leaned back in her chair, her fingers steepled in front of her chest.
"McAfee's going to ask you why Houghton would have pulled out gun B at all in the locker room if gun A had worked so splendidly up till that point."
Patrick shrugged.
"He might have used it to shoot Royston in the belly, and then when it jammed, switched back to gun A. Or then again, it might be even simpler than that. Since the bullet from gun B wasn't recovered, it's possible it was the very first shot fired. The slug could be lodged in the fiberglass insulation in the cafeteria, for all we know. It jammed, the kid switched to gun A and stuffed the jammed gun in his pocket. And then at the end of his killing spree, he either discarded it or dropped it by accident."
"Or. I hate that word. It's two letters long and stuffed to the gills with reasonable doubt." She broke off as there was a knock at the door, and her secretary stuck her head inside. "Your 2 o'clock's here." Diana turned to him. "I'm preparing Drew Gerard for testifying. Why don't you stay for this one?"
Patrick moved to a chair on the side of the room to give Drew the spot across from the prosecutor. The boy entered with a soft knock.
"Miss Levin?"
Diana came around her desk.
"Drew, thanks for coming in."
She gestured at Patrick. "You remember Detective Ducharme?"
Drew nodded at him. Patrick surveyed the boy's pressed pants, his collared shirt, his manners on display. This was not the cocky, big man on campus hockey star as he had been painted by students during Patrick's investigations, but then again, Drew had watched his best friend get killed. He'd been shot himself in the shoulder. Whatever world he had lorded over was gone now.
"Drew," Diana said, "we brought you in here because you got a subpoena, and that means you're going to be testifying sometime next week. We'll let you know when, for sure, as we get closer. But for now, I wanted to make sure you weren't nervous about going to court. Today we'll go over some of the things you'll be asked and how the procedure works. If you have any questions, we can cover those as well, okay?"
"Yes, ma'am."
Patrick leaned forward.
"How's the shoulder?"
Drew swiveled to face him, unconsciously flexing that body part.
"I still have to do physical therapy and stuff, but it's a lot better. Except..."
His voice trailed off.
"Except what?"
Diana asked.
"I'll miss hockey season this whole year."
Diana met Patrick's eye. This was sympathy for a witness.
Do you think you'll be able to play again eventually?
Drew flushed.
The doctors say no, but I think they're wrong.
He hesitated.
I'm a senior this year, and I was sort of counting on an athletic scholarship for college.
There was an uncomfortable silence, as no one acknowledged either Drew's courage or the truth.
So, Drew, Diana said, when we get into court, I'll start by asking your name, where you live, if you were in school that day.
Okay.
Let's try it out a bit, all right? When you got to school that morning, what was your first class?
Drew sat up a little straighter.
American history.
And second period?
English.
Where did you go after English class?
I had third period free, and most people with free periods hang out in the caf.
Is that where you went?
Yeah.
Was anyone with you? Diana continued.
I went down by myself, but when I got there, I hung out with a bunch of people.
He looked at Patrick.
Friends.
How long were you in the cafeteria?
I don't know, a half hour maybe?
Diana nodded.
What happened then?
Drew looked down at his pants and drew his thumb along the crease. Patrick noticed that his hand was shaking.
We were all just, you know, talking, and then I heard this really big boom.
Could you tell where the sound was coming from?
No, I didn't know what it was.
Did you see anything?
No.
So, Diana asked, what did you do when you heard it?
I made a joke, Drew said. I said it was probably the school lunch igniting or something. Oh, finally, that radioactive mac and cheese.
Did you stay in the cafeteria after the boom?
Yeah.
And then? Drew looked down at his hands.
There was this sound like firecrackers. Before anyone could figure out what it was, Peter came into the cafeteria. He was carrying a knapsack and holding a gun, and he started shooting.
Diana held up her hand.
I'm going to stop you there for a moment, Drew. When you're on the stand, and you say that, I'll ask you to look at the defendant and identify him for the record. Got it?
Yes.
Patrick realized that he wasn't just seeing the shooting the way he'd have seen any other crime. He wasn't even visualizing it playing out as a prequel to the chilling cafeteria videotape he'd watched. He was imagining Josie, one of Drew's friends, sitting at a long table, hearing those firecrackers, not imagining in the least what came next.
How long have you known Peter? Diana asked. We both grew up in Sterling. We've been in the same school, like, forever.
Were you friends?
Drew shook his head.
Enemies?
No, he said. Not really enemies.
Ever have any problems with him?
Drew glanced up. No.
Did you ever bully him?
No, ma'am, he said.
Patrick felt his hands curl into fists. He knew, from interviewing hundreds of kids, that Drew Gerard had stuffed Peter Houghton into lockers, had tripped him while he was walking down the stairs, had thrown spitballs into his hair. None of that condoned what Peter had done. But still, there was a kid rotting in jail. There were 10 people decomposing in graves. There were dozens in rehab and corrective surgery. There were hundreds, like Josie, who still couldn't get through the day without bursting into tears. There were parents, like Alex, who'd trusted Diana to get justice done on their behalf. And this little asshole was lying through his teeth. Diana looked up from her notes and stared at Drew. So if you get asked under oath whether you've ever picked on Peter, what's your answer going to be? Drew looked up at her, the bravado fading just enough for Patrick to realize he was scared to death that they knew something more than they were admitting to him. Diana glanced at Patrick and threw down her pen. That was all the invitation he needed. He was out of his chair in an instant, his hand grabbing Drew Gerard's throat.
Listen, you little fuck,
Patrick said. Don't screw this up. We know what you did to Peter Houghton. We know you were sitting front and center. There are 10 dead victims and 18 more who are never going to have the lives they thought they would. And there are so many families in this community that are never going to stop grieving that I can't even count them. I don't know what your game plan is here. If you want to play the choir boy to protect your reputation, or if you're just scared to tell the truth. But believe me, if you get on that witness stand and you lie about your actions in the past, I will make sure you wind up in jail for obstruction of justice.
He let go of Drew and turned away, staring out the window in Diana's office. He had no authority to arrest Drew for anything, even if the kid did perjure himself, much less send him to jail. But Drew would never know that, and maybe it was enough to scare him into behaving. Taking a deep breath, Patrick bent down and picked up the pen Diana had dropped and handed it to her.
Let me ask you again, Drew, she said smoothly. Did you ever bully Peter Houghton?
Drew glanced at Patrick and swallowed. Then he opened his mouth and started to speak.
It's barbecued lasagna,
Alex announced after Patrick and Josie had each taken their first bite. What do you think?
I didn't know you could barbecue lasagna, Josie said slowly.
She began to peel the noodles back from the cheese, as if she were scalping it.
How's that work exactly?
Patrick asked, reaching for the pitcher of water to refill his glass.
It was regular lasagna, but some of the insides spilled out into the oven, and there was all this smoke. And I was going to start over, but then I sort of realized that I was only adding an extra charcoal sort of flavor into the mix. She beamed. Ingenious, right? I mean, I looked in all the cookbooks, Josie, and it's never been done before, as far as I can tell.
Go figure,
Patrick said, and he coughed into his napkin.
I actually like cooking, Alex said. I like taking a recipe and, you know, going off on a tangent to see what happens.
Recipes are kind of like laws, Patrick replied. You might want to try to stick to them before you commit a felony.
I'm not hungry, Josie said suddenly.
She pushed her plate away, stood up, and ran upstairs.
The trial starts tomorrow, Alex said, by way of explanation.
She went after Josie, not even excusing herself first, because she knew Patrick would understand. Josie had slammed the door shut and turned up her music. It would do no good to knock. Alex turned the knob and stepped inside, reaching to the stereo to turn down the volume. Josie lay on her bed face down, the pillow over her head. When Alex sat down on the mattress beside her, she didn't move.
You want to talk about it?
Alex asked.
No,
Josie said, her voice muffled. Alex reached out and yanked the pillow off her head.
Try. It's just... God, Mom, what's wrong with me? It's like the world started spinning again for everyone else, but I can't even get back on the carousel. Even you two. You both must be thinking like crazy about the trial, too. But here you are, laughing and smiling like you can put what happened and what's going to happen out of your head, when I can't not think about it every waking second.
Josie looked up at Alex, her eyes filling with tears.
Everyone's moved on. Everyone but me.
Alex put her hand on Josie's arm and rubbed it. She could remember delighting in the sheer physical proof of Josie after she was born, that somehow, out of nothing, she had created this tiny, warm, squirming, flawless creature. She'd spend hours on her bed with Josie beside her, touching her baby's skin, her seed pearl toes, the pulse of her fontanelle.
Once, Alex said, when I was working as a public defender, a guy in the office threw a 4th of July party for all the lawyers and their families. I took you, even though you were only about 3 years old. There were fireworks, and I looked away for a second to see them, and when I turned back, you were gone, I started to scream, and someone noticed you lying at the bottom of the pool.
Josie sat up, riveted by a story she had never heard before.
I dove in and dragged you out and gave you mouth to mouth, and you spit up. I couldn't even speak, I was so scared. But you came back fighting and furious at me. You told me you'd been looking for mermaids, and I interrupted you.
Tucking her knees up under her chin, Josie smiled a little.
Really?
Alex nodded.
I said that next time you had to take me with you.
Was there a next time?
Well, you tell me, Alex said, and she hesitated. You don't need water to feel like you're drowning, do you?
When Josie shook her head, the tears spilled over. She shifted, fitting herself into her mother's arms. This, Patrick knew, was his downfall. For the second time in his life, he was growing so close to a woman and her child that he forgot he might not really be part of their family. He looked around the table at the detritus of Alex's awful dinner and started clearing the untouched plates. The barbecued lasagna had congealed in its serving dish, a blackened brick. He piled the dishes in the sink and began to run warm water, then picked up a sponge and started to scrub.
"Oh my gosh," Alex said behind him. "You really are the perfect man."
Patrick turned, his hands still soapy.
"Far from it."
He reached for a dish towel.
"Is Josie..."
"She's fine. She'll be fine. Or at least we're both going to keep saying that until it's true."
"I'm sorry, Alex."
"Who isn't?"
She straddled a kitchen chair and rested her cheek on its spine.
"I'm going to the trial tomorrow."
"I wouldn't have expected any less."
"Do you really think McAfee can get him acquitted?"
Patrick folded the dish towel beside the sink and walked toward Alex. He knelt in front of her chair.
"Alex," he said, "that kid walked into the school like he was executing a battle plan. He started in the parking lot and set off a bomb to cause a distraction. He went around to the front of the school and took out a kid on the steps. He went into the cafeteria, shot at a bunch of kids, murdered some of them, and then he sat down and had a bowl of fucking cereal before he continued his killing spree. I don't see how, presented with that kind of evidence, a jury could dismiss the charges."
Alex stared at him.
"Tell me something. Why was Josie lucky?"
"Because she's alive."
"No, I mean, why is she alive? She was in the cafeteria and the locker room. She saw people die all around her. Why didn't Peter shoot her?"
"I don't know. Things happen that I don't understand all the time. Some of them, well, they're like the shooting. And some of them..."
He covered Alex's hand with his own where it gripped the chair rail.
"Some of them aren't."
Alex looked up at him, and Patrick was reminded again of how finding her, being with her, was like that first crocus you saw in the snow. Just when you assumed winter would last forever, this unexpected beauty could take you by surprise. And if you didn't take your eyes off it, if you kept your focus, the rest of the snow would somehow melt.
"If I ask you something, will you be honest with me?"
Alex asked. Patrick nodded.
"My lasagna wasn't very good, was it?"
He smiled at her through the slats of the chair.
"Don't give up your day job," he said.
In the middle of the night, when Josie could still not get to sleep, she slipped outside and lay down on the front lawn. She stared up at the sky, which clung so low by this time of night that she could feel stars pricking her face. Out here, without her bedroom closing in around her, it was almost possible to believe that whatever problems she had were tiny in the grand scheme of the universe. Tomorrow, Peter Houghton was going to be tried for 10 murders. Even the thought of it, of that last murder made Josie sick to her stomach. She couldn't go watch the trial, as much as she wanted to, because she was on a stupid witness list. Instead, she was sequestered, which was a fancy word for being kept clueless. Josie took a deep breath and thought about a social studies class she'd taken in middle school where they'd learned that someone, Eskimos maybe, believed stars were holes in the sky where people who died could peek through at you. It was supposed to be comforting, but Josie had always found it a little creepy, as if it meant she was being spied on. It also made her think of a really dumb joke about a guy walking past a mental institution with a high fence who hears the patients chanting, 10, 10, 10, and goes to peek through a hole in the fence to see what's going on, only to get poked in the eye with a stick and hear the patients chant, 11, 11, 11. Matt had told her that joke. Maybe she'd even laughed. Here's what the Eskimos don't tell you. Those people on the other side, they have to go out of their way to watch you. But you can see them any old time. All you have to do is close your eyes. On the morning of her son's murder trial, Lacey picked a black skirt out of her closet, along with a black blouse and black stockings. She dressed like she was headed to a funeral, but maybe that wasn't so far off the mark. She ripped 3 pairs of hose because her hands were shaking, and finally decided to go without. By the end of the day, her shoes would rub blisters on her feet, and Lacey thought maybe this was a good thing. Maybe she could concentrate instead on a pain that made perfect sense. She didn't know where Lewis was, if he was even going to the trial today. They hadn't really spoken since the day she had tracked him to the graveyard, and he had taken to sleeping in Joey's bedroom. Neither one of them went into Peter's. But this morning, she forced herself to turn left instead of right at the landing, and she opened the door of Peter's bedroom. After the police had come, she had put it back in some semblance of order, telling herself that she didn't want Peter to come home to a place that had been ransacked. There were still gaping holes. The desk looked naked without its computer, the bookshelves half empty. She walked up to one and pulled down a paperback, The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. Peter had been reading it for English class when he was arrested. She wondered if he'd had the time to finish. Dorian Gray had a portrait that grew old and evil while he remained young and innocent-looking. Maybe the quiet, reserved mother who would testify for her son had a portrait somewhere that was ravaged with guilt, twisted with pain. Maybe the woman in that picture was allowed to cry and scream, to break down, to grab her son's shoulders and say, "What have you done?" She startled at the sound of someone opening the door. Lewis stood on the threshold, wearing the suit that he kept for conferences and college graduations. He was holding a blue silk tie in his hand and didn't speak. Lacey took the tie out of Lewis's hand and walked behind him. She noosed it around his neck, gently pulled the knot into place, and flipped down the collar. As she did, Lewis reached for her hand and didn't let go. There weren't words, really, for moments like this, when you realized that you'd lost one child and the other was slipping out of your reach. Still holding Lacey's hand, Lewis led her out of Peter's room. He closed the door behind them. At 6 a.m., when Jordan crept downstairs to read through his notes in preparation for the trial, he found a single place setting at the table, a bowl, a spoon, and a box of Cocoa Krispies, the meal he always used to kick off a battle. Grinning, Selena must have gotten up in the middle of the night to do this, since they'd headed up to bed together last night. He sat down and poured himself a healthy serving, then went into the fridge for the milk. A post-it note had been stuck to the carton. Good luck. Just as Jordan sat down to eat, the telephone rang. He grabbed it. Selena and the baby were still asleep.
Hello?
Dad? Thomas, he said.
What are you doing up at this hour?
Well, I sort of didn't go to bed yet. Jordan smiled.
Ah, to be young and collegiate again.
Anyway, I just called to wish you luck. It starts today, right? He looked down at his cereal and suddenly remembered the footage taken by the cafeteria video camera at Sterling High. Peter sitting down, just like this, to have a bowl of cereal, dead students flanking him. Jordan pushed the bowl away.
Yes, he said. It does.
The correctional officer opened up Peter's cell and handed him a stack of folded clothes.
Time for the ball, Cinderella, he said.
Peter waited until he left. He knew his mother had bought these for him. She'd even left the tags on so that he could see they hadn't come from Joey's closet. They were preppy, the kind of clothes he imagined were worn to polo matches, not that he'd ever actually been to one to see. Peter stripped out of his jumpsuit and pulled on the boxer shorts, the socks. He sat down on his bunk to pull up his trousers, which were a little tight at the waist. He buttoned the shirt wrong the first time and had to do it over. He didn't know how to do his tie right. He rolled it up and stuffed it into his pocket so that Jordan could help him. There wasn't a mirror in his cell, but Peter imagined he looked ordinary now. If you beamed him from this jail into a crowded New York street or into the stands of a football game, people probably wouldn't glance twice at him, wouldn't realize that underneath all that washed wool and Egyptian cotton was someone they'd never imagine. Or in other words, after all this, nothing had changed. He was about to leave the cell when he realized he hadn't been given a bulletproof vest, as he had for the arraignment. It probably wasn't because he was any less hated now. More likely, it had been an oversight. He started to ask the guard about it, but then snapped his mouth shut. Maybe, for the first time in his life, Peter had gotten lucky. Alex dressed like she was going to work, which she was, except not as a judge. She wondered what it would be like to sit in court in the role of civilian. She wondered if the grieving mother from the arraignment would be there. She knew it was going to be hard to listen to this trial and to understand all over again how close she had come to losing Josie. Alex was through pretending that she was listening only because it was her job. She was listening because she had to. One day, Josie would remember and would need someone to hold her upright. And since Alex hadn't been there the first time to protect Josie, she'd bear witness now. She hurried downstairs and found Josie sitting at the kitchen table, dressed in a skirt and blouse.
"I'm going," she announced.
It was déjà vu. This was exactly what had happened the day of Peter's arraignment, except that seemed so long ago, and she and Josie had both been very different people back then. Today, she was on the defense's witness list, but she hadn't been served with a subpoena, which meant that she didn't actually have to be in the courthouse at all during the trial.
"I know I can't go in, but Patrick's sequestered too, isn't he?"
The last time Josie had asked to go to court, Alex had flatly refused. This time, though, she sat across from Josie.
"Do you have any idea what it's going to be like? There are going to be cameras, lots of them, and kids in wheelchairs, and angry parents, and Peter."
Josie's gaze fell into her lap like a stone.
"You're trying to keep me from going again."
"No, I'm trying to keep you from getting hurt."
"I didn't get hurt," Josie said. "That's why I have to go."
5 months ago, Alex had made this decision for her daughter. Now she knew that Josie deserved to speak for herself.
"I'll meet you in the car," she said calmly.
She held this mask until Josie closed the door behind herself and then bolted upstairs to the bathroom and got sick. She was afraid that reliving the shooting, even from a distance, would rattle Josie past the point of recovery. But mostly she worried that for the second time, she would be powerless to keep her daughter from being hurt. Alex rested her forehead against the cool porcelain lip of the bathtub. Then, standing, she brushed her teeth and splashed her face with water. She hurried to the car, where her daughter was already waiting. Because the sitter was late, Jordan and Selena found themselves fighting the crowd on the courtroom steps. Selena had been expecting it, and still wasn't entirely prepared for the hordes of reporters, the television vans, the spectators holding up their camera phones to capture a snapshot of the melee. Jordan was playing the villain today. The vast majority of the onlookers were from Sterling, and since Peter would be transported to the court via underground tunnel, Jordan was their fall guy. "How do you sleep at night?" a woman shouted as Jordan hurried up the steps past her. Another held up a sign. "There's still a death penalty in New Hampshire." "Oh, boy," Jordan said under his breath. "This is gonna be a fun one."
"You'll be fine," Selena replied.
But he had stopped moving. There was a man standing on the steps, holding up a piece of poster board with two large mounted photos, one of a girl, one of a pretty woman. Caitlin Harvey, Selena realized, recognizing the face, and her mother. At the top of the display were two words, 19 minutes. Jordan met the man's gaze. Selena knew what he was thinking, that this could be him, that he had just as much to lose.
"I'm sorry," Jordan murmured,
and Selena looped her arm through his and pulled him up the stairs again. There was a different crowd up here, though. They wore startling yellow shirts with BVA printed across the chest, and they were chanting, "Peter, you are not alone. Peter, you are not alone." Jordan leaned closer to her. "What the fuck is this?"
"The bullied victims of America."
"You must be joking," Jordan said.
"They exist?"
"You better believe it," Selena said. Jordan started to smile for the first time since they'd started driving to court.
"And you found them for us?"
Selena squeezed his arm.
"You can thank me later," she said.
His client looked like he was going to faint. Jordan nodded at the deputy who led him into the holding cell where Peter was being kept at the courthouse and then sat down.
"Breathe," he commanded.
Peter nodded and filled up his lungs. He was shaking. Jordan had expected this, had seen it at the start of every trial he'd ever been a part of. Even the most hardened criminal suddenly panicked when he realized that this was the day his life was on the line.
"I've got something for you,"
Jordan said, and he took a pair of glasses out of his pocket. They were thick and tortoiseshell, Coke bottle glasses, very different from the thin wire ones Peter usually wore.
"I don't," Peter said, and then his voice cracked. "I don't need new ones."
"Well, take them anyway."
"Why?"
"Because everyone will notice these on your face," Jordan said. "I want you to look like someone who could never in a million years see well enough to shoot 10 people.
Peter's hands curled around the metal edge of the bench.
"Jordan, what's gonna happen to me?"
There were some clients you had to lie to, just so that they'd get through the trial. But at this point, Jordan thought he owed Peter the truth.
"I don't know, Peter. You haven't got a great case, because of all the evidence against you. The likelihood of you being acquitted is slim, but I'm still gonna do whatever I can for you. Okay?"
Peter nodded.
"All I want you to do is to try to be quiet out there. Look pathetic."
Peter bowed his head, his face contorting.
"Yes, just like that," Jordan thought.
And then he realized that Peter had started to cry. Jordan walked toward the front of the cell. This, too, was a familiar moment for him.